Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Here's a shared haiku. Nutrition for the first day of school for parents. Nutritious lunch, check. Backpack, school supplies, check, check. Tears, no. Just pollen.
I think Bootsy took another kid's snack day one.
Really?
Yeah, the Z-bar.
He ate his own and then he took someone else.
No, he couldn't find his own because mom put it in the small pouch. I think he just took another kid's.
Good for him. Be aggressive right away.
Kindergarten's late.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
Today we'll complete Bootsy's first full week of kindergarten. How's it going?
He's a changed young man. He seems older. He's taller. I mean, he's seen things. Kindergarten, this is real school. Mom went to back to school night. There's no free play.
It's just straight academics?
Straight phonics all day long.
Okay.
He loves it. He keeps talking about a robot that switches back and forth from letters to numbers. We are so grateful that he has transitioned to real school so happily. Although every day when you do drop off, he's still doing the holding your hand. He takes everything in. He knows he can tell you exactly what every kid is wearing each day. He doesn't know their names yet. And we've had no more snack incidents.
That's great.
He is downgraded from the full Z bar to a Sesame Street granola bar, which I think is easier to identify.
He could have a career. You know those commercials, those Jimmy John's commercials where the guy lets the air out of all the tires?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he could do that. I mean, if he's going to start stealing food early, that's a good way to go. I'm going to start with the tennis. I did something I never do. I watched women's doubles last night, because Serena is compelling. Sally Jenkins will be on in a little while to talk about Serena. Serena and Venus, they lost. It doesn't matter. It was just entertaining. I didn't really care about it one way or the other. But it was something I did. On the tennis circuit, let me commend to people a front page story today by Liz Clark about retirements in tennis. It's a really good story in the Washington Post. I think people will enjoy it. And I went back and forth last night between the Nats, and this was an extraordinary thing for me. The Nats had a 4 o'clock game yesterday because Thursday is traditionally getaway day, and they're playing Oakland, and Oakland has to get out of town. And so they accommodate the teams who have to get out of town by starting early sometimes on Thursdays, getaway days, so that you can play a Friday game if you don't have Thursday off. And at about 7 o'clock or 10 to 7 or so, I said, the Nats, maybe they're still on. It's a 4 o'clock start, so I'm anticipating around 3 hours. They're only in the seventh inning. They are down at that point, I think, by one run. I'm not sure of the order of the numbers, but I know the Nats caught up and forced it to go into a 10th inning. All right, Kyle Finnegan pitched the ninth. He escaped unscathed, had a good inning, and then the Nats go into the extra innings. In the extra innings, as people know, for the second or third year in a row, a runner starts on second base. You get a free runner at second base. A lot of teams like to bunt him over and then try and sacrifice him in. When you play in the Nats, you don't have to do that because Hunter Harvey is on the mound. And Hunter Harvey is consistently throwing 99 and 100. Like virtually every pitch is 99 and 100. He doesn't do anything else. He doesn't throw slow curveballs. He doesn't throw changeups. He comes at you 99 to 100. And the problem is, if you can time that and foul those pitches off, you get deep into a count, which is what happened last night. And he walked somebody, and somebody else got on. And then somebody on Oakland hit a ball to right field that hit the top of the wall. It missed being a home run by an inch. It hit the top of the wall and came back. And so now it's a two-run lead. So they're in the bottom of the 10th. Hunter Harvey has failed, totally failed. And they're in the bottom of the 10th. And Oakland has its closer or one of its closers on the mound. And I think, again, you start with somebody on second base. And I'm not being specific on this because I don't quite remember. The Nats were down to two outs. They had gotten one run in. They had somebody on second and somebody on first. I think Lane Thomas was on first because he walked. And somebody else was on second, and I don't know how he got to second, but it doesn't matter. Joey Meneses gets up. Folk
hero.
This is the kid. He's not a kid. He's 30 years old, who's been in the minor leagues until last month, until August, had been in the minor leagues his entire career. He has not been in the Nats organization his entire career. He's had other teams look at him and say, no, you are wanting, son. You are not good enough. We're not going to bring you up. He wasn't even brought up in the September call-ups. The first time he ever got to the major leagues was last month with the Nats, a desperate team, the worst team in baseball. This guy delivers a home run. It's the Nats, and this was, I don't know that this is extraordinary, but it struck me as extraordinary, to have played 120 games and not had a single walk-off situation. It's the first one for the Nats, obviously the first one for Meneses, a home run. He had like four hits last night. He's batting 350. He's been in the lineup, Michael, every day for 3 weeks at least.
Yeah.
He's batting 350. He's the best player on the team at the moment.
Yeah.
Keibert Ruiz is the best player, but this guy at the moment is the best player on the team. What is the scouting services that other teams have used that denied him? What has he done differently? This guy is a great story. You'd like to find out, how does this happen? He's 30, right?
Power of baseball. I mean, in a lost season, this is what you're looking for that brings you some joy about a team that is an absolute dumpster. But if you're being realistic, you talk about Ruiz. He is tracking where you think he should track. This story that comes completely out of nowhere, you go, how is it that nobody in your scouting department could predict this?
But it's not the Nats. He was with other teams. Didn't he just get to the Nats?
Yeah.
Nigel, can you look him up? Does he have a history with other teams, other organizations? He's going to be, I don't know how long he will stay in the majors. I don't know if he will be in the majors all next year, but he's going to get a contract. He's going to get a major league contract, and it's not going to be less than 2 years. He's going to get 2 years of major league money. It's not going to be a lot of money by major league standards. It might not even be $1 million a year, but it's going to be a lot more than he was making when he was getting on a bus in the minors for 10 years, trying to sustain himself any way that he can. He's going to get major league money. This is the thing in Bull Durham. He's in the show.
Yeah, and when you talk about J-Rod's extension, when you talk about the Soto offers, when you talk about where Judge is going to end up and go, like, these are the powerful stories of baseball.
This is a great story. I mean, I know that the Washington Post fairly consistently does a "we are surprised by Joey Meneses" story. But there ought to be a deep dive into this guy's career. I don't know. I don't know if he's a good talker, but he's been in the minors for 10 years. What do you got?
So he came up, he played with the Braves and their farm system from 2011 through 2017.
The Braves know what they're doing. Okay.
Then he went to the Phillies, signed a minor league deal with them. Played in the 2018 season with their the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs, wasn't sure that was the name.
Right.
Then went to Japan, played for the Oryx Buffaloes, then came back and played with the Red Sox in their AAA team, and then became a free agent last year in November and signed with the Nationals last January.
How old is he right now?
He's 30 years old, yeah.
He's been in the minors for 10 years, or Japan, or wherever he's been. When you're in the minors, I don't want to romanticize it, it's a hard life.
You don't
have any money at all. I mean, you're living with three other people, renting rooms, places,
scraping
by. You're taking the bus all the time. They don't fly anyplace. I think I read that he had a problem that they don't even have a lot of bats in the minor leagues, so you have to sort of repair your own bat. And when he got up to the majors and he found all the bats in the rack, it was like, it was in ecstasy. He's batting 350, right?
Major league
pitching, he's batting 350, and this is the first time he ever got a chance, and he only got a chance, Michael, because the Nats are terrible.
Meaningful baseball for the Nats in September because of him.
Right. They're terrible, so they'll try anything. They're not contending. They have no important games. They bring this kid up, and they stick him out there, and now they can't get him out of the lineup. Nobody can. He's a great story.
And you think, sort of the life-changing event that this will be, if he can just sign a one-year deal or something like that, that sort of money compared to what he was going to make in the minor leagues, it's just it really is a terrific story.
Did you listen to the show? I think I said that 45 seconds ago.
I think I said
he's going to probably get at least a two-year deal.
Nigel's had a few late nights.
He's not going to make a tremendous amount of money, but relative to what he had made.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I mean, he could get a two-year, $5 to $6 million package.
That changes his life, yeah.
Absolutely changes. Well, this whole, and he deserves it.
Yes. Yes, he does. He's
again, can I say this again? He's batting 350. He hit a walk-off home run last. How many hits did he have last night? You got a box there?
Yeah, it was four. I think it was four for six, yeah, because he drove in a run early in the game.
And once you get that validation, then it just continues where you get picked up and you get, you know, you become a rental and you extend your career by one or two more years.
Now, it is possible that people have no tape on him at all. How would they? He's been in the minor leagues. And they just say to a pitcher, yeah, when this guy comes up, see what you can do with him. And now they'll get tape on him, and now somebody will prepare pitchers to pitch to Joey Meneses, which is a great honor for Joey Meneses. It really is. But it is possible that he's a major league hitter. It's possible that even with tape, even with people paying attention to him and trying to get him out, it's possible he's a 270 major league hitter. And 270 is going to keep you in the league for 3 to 5 more years.
All you have to do is give a kid a bat.
Yeah, yep. It's just
pick so any of them,
last,
Joey.
I mean, it was just you. Exactly. I'm watching this last night, and it's storybook time. He hits it out, you know. He hits it out. And by the way, Coco, I don't know where Bob Carpenter is. I have no idea. But Coco's very good doing games. He's very enthusiastic. He and
he likes Franson, the other guy. They get along very well.
They do,
which they did when Kevin was playing.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So I get the cool thing about all this is there's actually reasons for us to text about baseball again. I'm sitting in the dark. I think I'm on verse 3 of Hallelujah for the second or third time to the hammer. Yeah. And I'm getting these excited texts about the walk-off.
Yeah. So it's really good. Okay. That's my open. I don't really have anything else. I recommended the Liz Clark story, and I talked a little bit about the tennis. Serena goes tonight. Well, I don't know if she goes tonight.
Yeah, she
does. I think they were trying to fool around with the schedule to make her go tonight. I would never, ever, if I were the U.S. Open, I would never, ever not put her on in the featured match at night.
Oh, yeah. No, I expect she is. I can look at the schedule. But
she draws a crowd.
Oh, yeah. It's been a packed house at Ash every
single night. Her crowd draws a crowd.
Yeah.
The lingering shots of Tiger. Tiger's arms.
Tiger's arms were unbelievable. Tiger looks like a bodybuilder. He can't do anything with his legs.
Fist pump I've seen from him in years.
Tiger looked great.
I've got her on the schedule 7 o'clock tonight at Arthur Ashe Stadium.
So they ought to just put that in permanently. She's on at 7, even when she's knocked out of the tournament. You put her on at 7 because she will draw a crowd.
Is the tribute from the other night still just running in the background?
That's what happens all with the Gail King thing or Queen Latifah. Just goes on and on and on. Yeah. And that's so demoralizing for an opponent.
Oh, sure.
I mean, the opponent is like, you expect someone to say to the opponent, hey, meat, get over here, get out there and just lose. Hey, meat. All right, we'll take a break. Sally, when we return?
Yes, that's right.
Sally's there. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Me, Joe Arrow, and Brandon Costello met Nigel downtown to pull a bank job. Have you heard? We entered the bank, the distractions commenced. Joe Arrow sang Broadway tunes with different words. Brandon Costello showed his paperwork. They said, you changed your name. He said, that's what I do. They said you've been Brandon Boker, Brandon Costello, Elvis Costello, Lou Costello, and Frank Costello, too. I sang them a song. It contained a very long list of other banks. They looked confused. I pulled a gun made out of soap. Then Nigel burst in, said, it's tea time, laddies. Tied all the employees up with a yardstick and a rope. Joe Arrow sang Luck Be a Baby from the bank president's seat. Costello posted selfies of stolen cash and his bare feet. I sang protest songs about Dave Roberts while Nigel scaled the walls. Changed his Indochino suit to a rust-colored one for fall. We might have got away with it. We did it by the book. But then the cops came, Liz, Frank, Edith, Saliza, Louise, Gluck. They tied us up with Nigel's yardstick and his rope. Venmo us in jail, it's free. Use the code, don't be a dope.
The brilliant Dan Byrne writes, hope you like the song. If you want to be our wheelman, I'll write you into the next song. Brilliant. Plays in Sally Jenkins. Let me just say this about Sally Jenkins for a second. Sally, as you know, is my friend and a great, great, great writer. Sally has been killing people for a couple of years now. Just killing people. She's been killing Dan Snyder. She's been killing the NCAA. Lately, she's been killing the Saudi tour. Sally's now excited about something. You're so excited about Serena Williams. It's so wonderful. Describe your mood when you sit down to write about her.
Oh, delight, you know, absolute delight. Who couldn't be? I mean, she's almost 41 years old. Her kid turned 5 yesterday. She's had a C-section and 2 pulmonary embolisms, and she's out there, you know, just killing people. It's great. It's great. She speaks to me, Tony. She kills people and I kill people.
Yeah, I understand that. I was saying before that even should she lose, the next night you should put her out there at 7 no matter what. It doesn't matter. She's drawing a crowd. She's the biggest ticket at the moment in New York City. What is the effect, you think, on the tournament to have her like this?
You know, I didn't think the U.S. Open could get sort of any more enormous. It's already such a big event. I mean, the stadiums are huge. And, you know, she drove up ratings 80% the other night.
Yeah.
And you literally in the plaza at the Billie Jean King Tennis Center, you got, like, at times you have to turn sideways to move. It's just packed out there. I mean, people are coming out just with a grounds pass, even if they can't get into a stadium, and they're watching on those big TVs out in the plaza. It's great. You know, it's the Open is always sort of a big Broadway occasion, but she's just jacked it up, you know. She really has.
We were talking about this yesterday off-air during PTI, and someone made the comment that they're going to put Venus and Serena on television playing doubles and asked me what I thought about it. I said, what do I think about it? You should do it every hour. I mean, are you kidding me? That this is the biggest. I sat there and watched that last night. And by the way, doubles is a much more vicious, faster game than I ever remember it being. It was really fun to watch. And I would imagine that everybody there who gets to watch Serena and or Venus and Serena goes home happy. Don't you think?
I think very happy. And, you know, it's fast-paced, the doubles, especially the way they play it, you know. I mean, 2 big serves and those big swinging volleys that Serena hits. I mean, she really takes a big old wind-up and cut at the ball, even when she's volleying, you know. So she's just all about, you know, real palpable power. And it's a blast to watch. I mean, you know, she just rears back and, like, blam, you know.
It reminds me, and again, I know if they have a brain in their heads, they will put her on, as long as she's in this tournament, they will put her on at night. And it reminds me of Jimmy Connors. The year was whispered into my ear last night because I thought it was the late 80s. But it was 1991 when Jimmy Connors, I believe, turned 37 during the Open and was done. He was basically done, except they put him on at night every single session that he stayed out there. He became the werewolf of center court, and he went all the way to the finals. I don't think Serena can win this, although you could convince me otherwise down the road. I don't think so. But I would keep putting her out there every single night because this now feels like the last one, doesn't it? Like, because there's some triumph in this. This feels like the exit, doesn't it?
Oh, very much so. And I think that, you know, as vague as she was in Vogue magazine, I don't think there's any question this is it. I mean, everything she said around it is pretty firm. I mean, you know, she just, yeah, this is it. And I think Connors was 39, actually.
Really?
And, I was at that tournament. I was at a couple of those night matches. And I was thinking just yesterday, this is the only thing that comes close to that. I mean, that's the category that, you know, she's in with her performances. And that felt huge at the time. But this really is bigger. I mean, the crowd noise, anyone who's covered a lot of Opens will tell you, they've never heard crowd noise like this. There's a different decibel and a different depth. It's louder, it's deeper, and it's, you know, it literally feels like something coming out of a jet engine. She said she feels it in her chest, you know, when she walks out there, like the vibration. I was, you know, I've been straining for like 3 days now to sort of say, okay, what does it sound like? You know, it sounds like a rock slide. It sounds like a tidal wave. It sounds like, you know, the North Atlantic Ocean in December. I mean, it's hard to describe how it sounds, really.
I've got to say this. One of the reasons I thought she would win the first match, and one of the reasons I thought she would beat the number two woman in the world, who, by the way, has never won anything, one of the reasons was because I don't think that these other women have any idea what it is like to be out there with a crowd that hates you, that cheers only when you screw up and Serena wins another point. I think this is potentially temperamentally devastating. What do you think?
I absolutely agree. I mean, first of all, Contevite said that she wasn't really prepared for the way Serena raised her game in the third set.
Which
is what the true greats really do. I mean, you face a different player in a third set than you faced in the first and second set. They have a fourth gear of, you know, that other players don't see coming. And that's exactly what happened to the number two player in the world who's not used to being number two and facing a creature like Serena Williams, number one. And number two, yeah, Chris Clary of the New York Times had the best line. He said that even when the crowd clapped for Contevite, he said it sounded like a golf clap.
Absolutely. I mean, even trying to be polite, I mean, they want her to not get a single point. They want her to hit every return into the net or long. They cheer mistakes because they are so wrapped up in Serena Williams. She has 23 of these things. I don't think there's anybody left in the draw who's got more than two. I don't think so. She's got 23 of these things, which leads to this question. Why can't she win?
Oh, she can, especially against
you believe
the competition.
That? You believe she
I
can?
Do believe it.
Okay.
I do believe it. I did not necessarily believe it last year or the year before, because now here's what she's going to have to do to win. She's going to have to beat an opponent who makes her uncomfortable. The people she's played so far have been big hitters, big power hitters, and she eats that for lunch.
Yeah.
You know, the people who've given her trouble in the last couple of years have been very handsy, very crafty players with a lot of spin and a lot of drop shots and a lot of short angles, and that's the stuff that I've watched her, you know, have a little trouble defeating in a final match. So she's going to need a little luck in terms of who she plays, you know, and how they play her. But if, you know, she keeps playing like this and she can keep her game up this way for four more matches, no question she can win it. You know, I don't see why not, particularly because, as you say, there's not a big depth of experience out there in terms of winning Grand Slams. For God's sake, last year the winner of the U.S. Open was a qualifier.
Raducanu was a qualifier last year.
Yeah.
She went out in the first round. There's a lot of women in the last 5 years who've won one or two majors who then get bounced out early on the next two or three majors. That has happened consistently and never happened with Serena. If I was playing Serena, I would absolutely try to keep her on the court as long as possible. She's going to be 41 in an hour and a half. You know, I wouldn't let her stand there and hit hard. I'd make her move all the time, and I would think I would tire her out and beat her. Isn't that the strategy?
Yeah, and I think as much as anything, you have to tire her out mentally by annoying her. You know, the short balls, the slices. You know, Muguruza, who beat her in the Open final a couple of years ago. I'm forgetting exactly which year, but she. You know, she sliced and diced her, you know, and after a while, Serena gets a little impatient with that because she can't generate as much power and she can't really generate kind of the winners that she likes to. You know, she can't just drive you off the court with that. So, you know, I think something like that could take her down. But also the other thing that could take her down is the fact that at 41, like you say, or on the cusp of 41, there are days when you wake up and your body just doesn't, the engine just won't start, and you can't find it. You know, the body can betray you a little bit over seven matches, and that's what happened to Chris Evert in 1989, another tournament I was at. Evert had a great run to the quarterfinals, She was beloved. It was pandemonium. The crowds were around her were so heavy and thick that at one point Martina Navratilova couldn't even get her match. She had to have help getting through the crowds for Chrissy.
Well, maybe she could have taken that dog with her to clear the way. And Tyson.
Exactly. But Chrissy comes out and she beats Monica Seles. It's the last great match of her career. I mean, she just blows Seles off the court. It's one of the more masterful displays of tennis I ever saw ever give. And then she comes out in the quarterfinals against Zina Garrison, an opponent that she could have and should have beaten and just didn't have anything left. I mean, it was all of a sudden it was empty. And yeah. You realized, okay, she'd been playing on an eighth of a tank, and the needle just hit empty.
Yeah.
And that could happen here. It could be that Serena's playing on the last little, you know, inch of gas in the tank and the last fumes, and you just don't know when that needle's gonna slide below the empty mark. So it's gonna be so interesting, but it's so great in the meantime, you know, to be there. It's such an occasion. And and by the way, can we just stop saying Margaret Court's name ever again as one of the best player, you know, as the best player in history?
She was a very, very great player for a brief amount of time who won 11 Australian Opens.
And yeah. In the 1960s, before open tennis, when the fields had like 12 people in them.
That's right.
All
that's
amateurs. Right. I mean, well, it shouldn't even be a comparison. And by the way, in two of those 24 Grand Slam finals, her opponents retired, and she didn't even play a full final.
So oh, I didn't realize
that. To me, she should have 22.
So let me go into this for a second, because you mentioned Chris Cleary before. He wrote a big piece I read the other day in the New York Times about the GOAT thing. Me personally, because of my age and because of what I have seen, I would say, and I'll rank them in alphabetical order, Evert, Graf, King, Navratilova, Williams, those five. I believe you could throw a blanket over them, and if you picked one and I picked another, it would be okay. But in my mind, Martina Navratilova is the greatest player of all time, not Serena Williams. That's just in my mind. What about in your mind?
So that's a complicated question for the simple reason that Evert and Navratilova have 18 Grand Slam titles each, and in most of them they had to face each other.
Each other, yes.
And so I count them as having 36 in some ways. I count Evert and Navratilova as one player with 36 majors. Like, when you play that intellectual game, because I don't know of any other great champion in the sport who had to do that, who had to, in order to win another Grand Slam title, had to go through literally one of the top three players of all time.
Right, right.
Either in a semifinal or final, you know. I mean, Court and Billie Jean and Margaret Court had a great rivalry, but they didn't really play each other very often. They only played each other in two or three finals, I think, for Grand Slam titles.
And Graf did not have to play Seles all the way through because of Günter Parch.
Yeah, I mean, so imagine if Borg and McEnroe had to play each other 36 times for Grand Slam titles.
Right.
Right? I mean, Evert Navratilova really, in my mind, among other things, is the greatest sports rivalry of all time because of the disparate styles, because of the energy on the court when they played. I mean, their Evert's last two French Open victories in 1985 and 1986 are two of the most riveting. And then her U.S. Open loss in 86. Those three matches, the tennis in those, go back and watch them, pull them up on your screen. Even today, the tennis is just absolutely gripping. It holds up, you know. So there's that aspect of the question that's really kind of peculiar that gets in the way for me of saying that Serena is outright the greatest ever, because I don't think Serena had to play a Navratilova or an Evert every time out. You know, that's the only divot I can take out of her historical legacy.
You should write that. I think there's this assumption, because people stand up and scream it, that Serena is the greatest of all time.
I mean, she is numerically.
Because if she wins this, wins this at 40, basically at 41 years old, I'll yield on this one. I really will. So,
yeah,
I just think that's interesting. I do.
Well, yeah. And by the way, Evert and Navratilova, neither one of them ever made a Grand Slam final after pregnancy, after a C-section. I mean, there's a remarkability to what she's doing physically You know, she's Tom Brady in the sense of she's creating a really a new template of what, you know, physical recovery can be, what the age envelope can be for athletes. You know, there's the idea now that you have to retire in your, I mean, Everett went at 33, I think. Navratilova went at 38. The idea that, you know, you have to go in your 30s, I think, is a, I think Serena has changed that one.
I'm so happy to hear you excited like this. I just think it's wonderful.
Great. I mean, no, I don't always kill people. I don't really kill people.
You do.
It's like, you know what? Harry Truman, everybody said, give him hell, Harry. And he said, I don't give him hell. I just tell the truth and they think it's hell.
It's a good line. It's a good line. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Sal.
I don't kill people. I just tell the truth.
Thank you, Sally. Sally
you,
Jenkins,
Tony.
Boys and girls. Wonderful. We will have Chuck Culpepper. It's an all Washington Post day. Chuck Culpepper, when we return, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Ralph Rillon. He writes, I'm a longtime local singer and musician. I've been performing at various venues throughout the DMV and along the East Coast for quite a few years, more than I care to elaborate on. I've always greatly appreciated you playing my songs in the past, which is a thrill for me and my loyal little friends. I, too, am a loyal little. Thoroughly enjoy listening to the podcast, which is entertaining and informative. Thank you. And yes, I do use the code. This is called Just Feeling Fine. And again, this is Ralph Rillon. This is quite good. Michael, if people like Ralph Rillon want to send in their original music for us to play, how do they do it?
Send us your music by emailing it to jingles@tonykornheiserhow.com.
Chuck Culpepper joins us now. We could have talked to Chuck Culpepper about tennis because he knows tennis, but we talked to Sally about the tennis. And we'll talk to Chuck about college football. I understand you are going to Ohio State for the Ohio State-Notre Dame game. I would imagine that's something to be excited about. And as I was talking to Pat Forty the other day, I have the same feelings now. How did they schedule a game like that as an opener? How did they get these teams to agree to it?
Well, they've got it coming back next year to South Bend as a fourth game, I think it is, for so that's it's late in September next year. So yeah, that is an oddity. And then there's something even odder about it, which is that, you know, those when big recruits have their signing ceremonies in the high school gyms. And,
yeah.
And there's this linebacker from suburban Dayton, Ohio, in 2003 had his, and it was Marcus Freeman, who has three caps in front of him. One's Ohio State, one's Notre Dame, and one's Michigan. And he picks the Ohio State one, but he's now coaching the new head coach of one of the other caps. So, you know, there's a lot of really unusual things about this. And I think the idea that it's the opener is going to make it, that's going to make it even harder for Notre Dame. It's a very, very tall ask for them at this point, I think.
It would be fantastic for Notre Dame to win this game. If I were Marcus Freeman and this was my first regular season game as a coach, I would say to my AD, you're killing me. What are you doing to me? Right?
Right. And the AD, of course, there today was there in 2014, which is when this game was arranged. I think it's, And then throw on that, you know, a quarterback in his first big start, Tyler Buchner, and I think, you know, he's from Southern California, from San Diego. He wound up his career at the same high school that like Alex Smith and Reggie Bush went to, and now I think he missed his senior year because of COVID, and now he's come to this, and he was back up last year and. This is he's going to go into the horseshoe for his first game. So this just looks really, I mean, yes, like you were saying, I'm excited. The names are big, you know, but this just really looks like, you know, being led to slaughter.
Now, this is the kind of game that if Ohio State shows well, and I'm not saying they will, I don't know anything about either team, but if Ohio State shows well and you're a voter, you're going to vote them ahead of Alabama next week at number one, don't you think?
Absolutely. And one of the best things about this system that's been in place for this will be the ninth season with the committee is that the committee has shown big respect for scheduling like this. And so, you know, obviously the committee won't get into it yet, not until late October. But, you know, this is the kind of game that all along through the years should have, you know, flipped rankings. And now it's done more than it used to be done. It used to be, you know, you're preseason number one, you keep winning and nothing changes. But yes, even though Alabama's considered one of the greatest favorites ever this year, with a Heisman winner and then a linebacker who's probably even a better football player than anybody in the country, that it should be one of those occasions, yes, when Ohio State, if they win impressively, yeah, they should move ahead.
I agree. By the way, the adventure scheduling continues. Oregon and Georgia. I mean, that's, you know, Georgia's the defending national champion. Oregon is now coached by somebody who coached at Georgia, right, with Kirby Smart, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Right.
And Oregon has the kid from Auburn, Bo Nix,
right,
at quarterback, which I guess leads me to this. I think a lot of people out there think that the name, image, and likeness will have a greater effect on college sports than anything else. I don't. I think it's the transfer portal. People wake up on a Tuesday, and by Wednesday, they're at another school. I just find the shuffling of players to schools amazing. Do you think that there will be any attempt to sort of narrow this?
I don't think so. I think the players have gotten their measure of power that they, you know, didn't have for 100 years. And I agree with every vowel and consonant of that the NIL is not as big a thing
it's
as
not.
The transfer portal. And, you know, last night there was a game between Pitt and West Virginia, rivalry game in which both starting quarterbacks had quarterbacked at USC already during their careers. You know, it's really something, and it's something people aren't used to. And this makes me think about Kentucky basketball, which is where, you know, when John Calipari went to the one and done for so many years. And some of the fans I knew, quite a few of them, in fact, what they missed was really getting to know the players and know the intricacies of their personalities and their games. They felt like they knew them after, say, 4 years, 5 years of watching them. And I think that's what's being lost in this, even though we all would agree, I think, that it's an very American thing that you get to go to the school you want to when you want to.
I agree with it in principle, but it is such a wow. When I found out the other day that the Oregon quarterback was Bo Nix, I said, well, he must be 26 years old by now. Hasn't he used up his eligibility and he's got this one more year? And they fly around like mosquitoes. They're just going from school to school. They're alighting for 10 minutes and going someplace else, right?
Right. And, you know, you look at, I mean, these are extremely well-traveled 21-year-olds in a lot of cases. You look at Caleb Williams, now out at USC, was a high school quarterback in Washington, D.C., and then at Oklahoma. He's got just one more continental time zone left to live in before he finishes college. You know, he's got 3 out of 4 already. So, it's disorienting. Yes.
There are two things in college sports that are of enormous consequence. One is the transfer portal, and the other is the wild moves in the conferences. Do you expect anything upcoming? Are you hearing anything about other conferences, other schools moving? Because when USC and UCLA join the Big Ten, you have to sit down and try to absorb that. That's amazing.
It is, and I don't know if that wasn't the moment that kind of, I've always followed college sports. I've always loved it. College football especially. For me, it's like growing up in the South was the signal that the harsh summer was ending and much more than that. But that move, I've always liked the idea that you had one region playing here and one region playing over here, and then occasionally they get together and measure the regions against each other. So the idea that they're going to be in the Big Ten and it stretches from, you know, Westwood in West L.A. all the way to Rutgers is kind of intimate College Park is it just kind of fundamentally changes something for me. It's almost as if the sport and college sports are kind of shedding their charms in a way.
I agree with that. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I know that there is, for me, something fundamentally wrong with this new alignment. I mean, I can live with Oklahoma and Texas going to the SEC, and I can sort of bemoan the end of the Big Eight, which happened 100 years ago, which I thought was the best football conference of them all at one point. But when you cover the entire country, come on, enough is enough. When my school, when Binghamton, in order to find a golf league, ends up, you know, playing in the conference. What's that conference that starts in Utah and Montana? That's where they are in golf, like the Big Sky. That's ridiculous. The Big Sky, there's no sky in Binghamton. There's always clouds. There is no sky. And when you have to do that, I believe that these conferences, I guess just because I grew up with them, being geographically compact, I think that's the natural order of things, and that the natural order of things has been moved in a bad way. And I guess you agree.
I do. And I think, you know, the great Frank DeFord had this line in an essay he wrote one time, said sports were never meant to be covered like NATO or the bond market. And I kind of feel like, you know, it's just so much talk about business.
Yeah.
And this move was all business.
Oh, yeah.
It's so much more business than sports, you know, and something's lost in there. I never wanted to be that guy who said that, but I always wanted to try to adapt, but something's lost in that move.
No, absolutely. And patient zero is Boston College. They're the worst. They started this whole thing and now it can't be stopped. I'll get you out of here on this. I'll completely change gears because I know you've followed this, the sortie tour and everything that's going on in golf. Cam Smith the other day, the most recent person to take the money, said, it's not fair that we can't play the majors, which just seems to me to be at the heart of everything. That the heart of everything in golf is the ability to play in the majors. What do you see coming up for everyone to play in the majors?
I just get the sense that for a while at least, both of these tours are going to thrive. To some degree, both of them are going to be successful to some degree at least, and both of them are going to have access to the majors, I would say. I just can't see the majors, you know, shutting out, especially when you get to Cam Smith. He's got exemptions for 5 years, having just won the British this year. So I just think for a while, there might even be within the majors this kind of even entertaining pull between the two. And to see, you know, which tour can do better. And it might even, dare I say, be helpful for the game a bit. I mean, I just think, yes, the majors are so powerful. This has concerned a lot of people that the majors are all anybody thinks about. It's where all the legacies are built and everything. But I just see it as something where, at least for a while, that they're still going to have access to it. I'll be surprised if they kind of get shut out of that. And I'll be very curious to see if the format of the LIV Tour, which is, I just find absurd, really.
Yeah.
I'm just curious to see if somehow that diminishes them competitively.
Because they're only playing 54 holes and not 72?
No cuts and guaranteed money.
Yeah.
Like Tiger was saying, why do you even practice, you know, back in Scotland, he said that. And it's just, you know, I don't know if it will. And they certainly perform well at St. Andrews. But I do just wonder if, you know, if playing in that kind of sort of has an exhibition feel to it, the shotgun starts and all of that. I don't know if over time that could take an edge off somebody.
Thank you, Chuck. Pleasure to have you on the show. It's great.
Thank
pleasure
you, Tony,
for me.
So much.
Chuck Culpepper, boys and girls. We'll take a break, and we will do email and jingle when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
That was very low in my ear. What happened with that? Was there a problem with that? That's Brandon Costello. Was there anything, a problem? Is it just my headset?
I think it was just your headset.
I think that was the after hours version.
Okay, because it's very, very low in my ear. Nigel, you want to do the Bethesda Bagel ad?
Yes, Bethesda Bagels. We love them. You will as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com for the location in the D.C. area nearest you. Then pop on in and you'll be thrilled.
All right, that'll just about do it for us today. Before we get to the mailbag, let me just say, imagine me and you, I do. I think about you day and night. It's only right to think about the girl you love. It's only right. So happy together. Those are the Turtles. I liked the Turtles. Very happy, poppy little group, the Turtles. I believe they played at Trisha Nixon's wedding in the White House 50 years ago. I believe I have that right. Thanks to our guests today. Sally Jenkins and Chuck Culpepper, thanks to today's sponsors, Electric E-Bike and Shopify. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Odyssey. If you get the show through Apple, please leave us a review. We will not do a show on Monday. We will do Tuesday. We'll do three shows next week, but Monday is Labor Day, and there's a golf tournament, and I'm going to play in it.
Chance of rain.
Chance of rain?
Yep.
Well, if it rains, then we'll do a show.
Big bagel news. They were giving out gift cards today. There were at least 30 people in line before open at 7 a.m. I could barely get in. Thank you. Thank you to those customers who listened to my plea and let me enter the shop so I could pick up the bagels.
Yes, and thank you to you for doing that.
I do it all for the show, Dad. From TK Week 1, you're Johnny Oko. Check out the new lightweight hoodie, the Finney.
TK Week 1.
TK Week 1, all in.
Bill in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Okay, I'll play. My phone pocket varies depending on the pant I'm wearing. Sometimes front left, but mostly back left. Hope this helps. From a haiku from Shad. 21 places is about Sean and all of his addresses. 21 places and all over the country. Fugitive, perhaps? From Josh in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. Did he really say there was enough liquidity to bet on women's water polo? Was that Jeff Ma saying that? Because he's a water polo guy. From Scott Hodgins in Dorchester in Ontario in Canada. I'm not going to question Greg Garcia's assertion that Freevee is in fact free, but I would remind you of the misguiding branding created by Next Day Blinds and Giant Foods. Just saying. From Tyler Etchenkamp in Lincoln, Nebraska. Phone and chapstick in front right pocket. Wallet and keys in front left pocket. Tell John Buchanan from Annapolis to eat it. From Patrick Sitter, a longtime emailer in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I've never been a fan of chocolate. When it comes to chocolate ice cream, I've always felt it tasted like, well, what it looks like. Despite that, guess what I just brought home from the grocery store? Yep, you guessed it. A carton of Tillamook mudslide ice cream. My wife, who loves chocolate, is very happy with the purchase. However, she's having a hard time understanding my recent obsession with Whoppers and fries. I keep telling her it's the power of the show, babe. It's the power of the show. From Matt in San Antonio, 19 permanent addresses, 5 countries, 3 United States states. I assume this is the new game. From Daphne. This is Daphne from Japan, just living and working here, not born and bred. This is my second post from Japan. You read my first one during the Olympics when I provided my personal observations of the crowds. I was thrilled you read my email, by the way. It made my day. I don't intend to make post from Japan a regular feature, though it does sound catchy, since I'm not so presumptuous as to think you would actually read my emails on a regular basis, and I'm also not normally one to jump on bandwagons, but I could not resist this one. Me and the man to whom I'm related by marriage were on a short vacation to Hiroshima. As we walked walked down one of the main thoroughfares called Hiroshima Handori, I saw this Burger King sign, immediately thought of you and your DCBK experience. I told my husband I had to take a picture and send it to you. He didn't get the joke, but he humored me anyway. So for 550 to 650 Japanese yen on the King Value menu, you get what looks like to me a Whopper or a Bullseye Whopper or a Whopper Deluxe with a Coke and fries. At today's exchange rate, that's $4.02 to 4.75 United States currency. Is that savings enough to get you to jump on a plane to Japan? I didn't think so, but it's a fun thought. From Nick Sharkey in Washington, D.C., but soon to be in Escanaba, Michigan. Am I being prescient in assuming the new game is the permanent address game? As of next week, when I leave D.C. for Michigan's Upper Peninsula, I will be at 22 permanent addresses, and hopefully I'll be buying a house soon thereafter, so I may get to 23 by year's end. Eat that, Sean. As the official data scientist of the Tony Kornheiser Show, I have some stats. Those 22 addresses have occurred over 6 states, 14 cities, and 42 years. It turns out the combo of undergrad and grad school, working in politics, and a marriage then divorce help rack up the count. I've also had a top secret clearance, so knowing these addresses off the top of my head is pretty easy. If you're curious about each address, I can send them to Chuck Todd, and he can read them to you when he's on the show. One of them was on the other side of Rock Creek Park from you, and I still curse Military Road, but driving by Ingleside was always good for a laugh. From Carl in Oswego, New York. So you decided to let Sean talk, and he immediately started a new game? Okay, I'll go. I've had 8 different permanent addresses, not counting college dorms, across 2 states, New York and West Virginia. I hope I'm playing the game right. Let me know. From Paul Dom in Washington, D.C. Stopped at Wendy's off I-81 in Pennsylvania last weekend on the way to Binghamton to visit family. Yes, that Binghamton. We ordered a double cheeseburger, a junior cheeseburger, and regular fries, not the best or healthiest lunch we've had in a while, and the total came to $11.57. I immediately said to my wife, that can't be right, they forgot my burger. I guess your experience probably has to do with the higher real estate costs on Connecticut Avenue in D.C. compared to small-town Pennsylvania, but anyway, thanks for making my drive-thru experience more stressful than necessary.
Spicy chicken nuggets.
Is that
what you got to get at Wendy's?
Is yeah,
the spicy nugs.
Yeah, that's but I'm
just modifying
the
I'm just modifying the order.
Should we do one more? This is Jason Smorrell again with an update on La Cheeserie Night.
Getting closer.
So I was catching up on old shows last week while driving my daughter to college. I'm usually a month or so behind. This La Cheeserie Night thing has screwed up my system, and now I have to listen to current episodes. I'll get over it. How surprised was I to hear Jake Hafner writing the mailbag commenting on your $13.27 Whopper and fries? He has time to randomly write, but no time to do his actual job of writing about La Cheeserie Night. Well, you get what you pay for. You'll be happy to know that as part of the promotion, we'll be raising the price of our hamburger and fry combo to $13.27, in addition to lots of other little nuggets of fun. There seems to be some confusion as to how this promotion is working. Please let the littles know to use the code. Yes, people, it's as simple as saying La Cheeserie at the ticket window, and you will get a free ticket. I've received a few emails from people asking how the night works. My reply has been, use the code. I thought TBA on the website would be funny, as this show is literally the only place we are promoting the promotion. This has been lots of fun, and we can't wait to meet the great Dan Byrne and see how many La Cheeseries we get. The new over-under is set at 18. Please tell people to use the code on Wednesday, September 7th, and I will send an update after the night. Oh, tell Jake to eat it. That's really good. That's really good. We'll stop with that. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
But I still need a bit of milk, full fat, which I've warmed in the microwave.
Me, Joe Arrow, and Brandon Costello met Nigel downtown to pull a bank job. Have you heard? We entered the bank, the distractions commenced. Joe Arrow sang Broadway tunes with different words. Brandon Costello showed his paperwork. They said, you changed your name. He said, that's what I do. They said, you've been Brandon Boker, Brandon Costello, Elvis Costello, Lou Costello, and Frank Costello, too. I sang them a song. It contained a very long list of other banks. They looked confused. I pulled a gun made out of soap. Then Nigel burst in, said, it's tea time, laddies. Tied all the employees up with a yardstick and a rope. Joe Arrow sang Luck Be a Baby from the bank president's seat. Costello posted selfies of stolen cash and his bare feet. I sang protest songs about Dave Roberts while Nigel scaled the walls. Changed his Indochino suit to a rust-colored one for fall. We might have got away with it, we did it by the book. But then the cops came, Liz, Frank, Edith, Saliza, Louise, Gluck. They tied us up with Nigel's yardstick and his rope. Venmo us in jail, it's free. Use the code. Don't be a dope.
Tonight's tonight. Sunrise, just feeling fine. It's been coming on for some time. We've been feeling it, you know it's not a lie. We've been sharing our ups and downs, putting our hearts on the line. Can you tell by the look in my eyes? I'm serious as I can be. I can see it when I look in your eyes. Let's turn the lights down low. Let our feelings finally come alive. Holding each other all night long. Tonight's the night we're gonna set it on fire. Light a few candles and light up all desires. Sunrise, just feeling fine. Tonight's the night we're gonna set it on fire.